Our study this morning, we have a little bit different topic. I don't know how many lessons you've heard before that are based off of taxes. But that's kind of what we're talking about this morning, a lesson I've entitled Follow the Money. I hope this is a kind of an interesting lesson. It's one that's going to kind of take us throughout really the entire Bible and maybe help to answer a few questions that we might have in the past. That, or maybe now that we can answer that we couldn't have in the past. People have always had to deal with money. It's just part of, it's just a necessary evil of life. We have to have some means by which to exchange commerce with one another. And it's always been that case. All the way back in the book of Exodus, the 30th chapter, it says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, When you take the census of the children of Israel for their number, then every man shall give a ransom for himself to the Lord. And when you number them, that there may be no plague among you when you number them. That is what everyone among those who are numbered shall give, half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary. A shekel is 20 gerahs. And the half shekel shall be an offering to the Lord." And so I'll let this footnote in here. This word ransom right here, it literally means the price of a life. And so it was very, very tied with words like propitiation and atonement. It's this idea of someone purchasing one's life. Verse 11, "Everyone included among those who are numbered from 20 years old and above shall give an offering to the Lord. The rich shall not give more, and the poor shall not give less than half a shekel. When you give an offering to the Lord to make atonement for yourselves, and you shall take the atonement money of the children of Israel and shall appoint it for the service of the tabernacle of meeting, that it may be a memorial for the children of Israel before the Lord to make atonement for yourselves." So every Jewish male from the age of 20 and older was to pay this half shekel tax. I guess we would call it a flat tax, because it was the same no matter if you're rich or poor. There wasn't a sliding scale like our income tax today. It was a flat tax. And it was used for the usage and the upkeep of the sanctuary and the tabernacle. Over the years, it would become known as the temple tax, as the temple was established there in the city of Jerusalem. And there's a reason for it. There's a reason for this half shekel. It was a ransom. It was a propitiation. It was an atonement that would forever remind the Israelites that their very life was a gift from God. And they had to pay for their life. Basically, as what was being said, they had to put their money where their mouth was. That they belonged to God and God had ransomed them. That was the purpose of this tax. Now, I looked it up. Half a shekel, they say, is approximately a fifth of an ounce of silver. And I looked it up. It's really not that much in today's money. It's just a couple of dollars. I don't know what it would have been back in those days. For poor folks, I'm sure it was probably hard to come up with half a shekel of silver. But that began something that we're going to be able to trace really throughout a lot of the Bible, is the concept of the temple tax. And the purpose of the tax, and before too long, we're going to be able to follow the money. I think we're going to come up with a pretty good lesson that we can learn from this morning. Before we go further, though, let's take time right now to humble ourselves and go to God in a word of prayer. Well, let's start this morning with just a simple show of hands. How many of y'all appreciate and enjoy paying taxes to the government? I'm guessing we're not going to get many. I'm right now currently in the midst of a fight with Tom Green County over the property value of some of our homes. And so we'll see how that turns out. You know, but nobody likes to pay taxes. I think it kind of puts a different perspective what this temple tax was, though, that it was a ransom. That what the Israelites were saying was they were paying God for their life. They were paying God for their right to live. Now, that's kind of an interesting thought, I suppose. I don't quite feel the same way about it with Tom Green County right now. I think they want me to pay a whole lot more than what I should. But that's kind of the way taxes go. But as we start out with taxes, as the years go by, taxes and money just becomes part of everyday people's life, including Jesus and his apostles. And so you may be able to think a little bit about some of the episodes that Jesus had involving tax. And there was even a tax collector by the name of Matthew. And there's a lot of stuff that involves this government money. It's just part of the lives that we have. Thanks to Roman legislation sponsored by none other than Julius Caesar and Augustus Caesar, Jewish religious liberties were protected by Roman law. And so even after Israel as a nation ceased to exist, the religion of the Israelite people was protected by Roman law. And one of this, they allowed the Jews to continue to collect their temple tax. And I don't guess the Romans really had to allow them to do that, but they did. Rome kind of had an interesting relationship with the Jews. Pretty much two things. Don't cause problems and pay your taxes. And if they would do that, then the Romans would pretty much leave the Jews alone. And so anytime there was kind of a threat of violence, the Romans would usually back off. Remember old Pontius Pilate, what Paul was reading this morning, right before that, he was real worried about the trial of Jesus, and he said he saw a tumult was going to be raised, that there was getting some problems, so he just backed up and said, I wash my hands, and y'all Jews do what you want to do. Because he didn't want to rock the boat any, because the Romans did not enjoy it when the Jews started revolting and acting up. We'll talk about that here in a little while in a minute. But I want you to think, in the time of Jesus, he was actually questioned about this temple tax. It's found in Matthew the 17th chapter, verses 24 through 27. Matthew 17, verse 24. It says, when they had come to Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the temple tax? He said, yes. And when he had come into the house, Jesus anticipated him, saying, what did you think, Simon? For whom do the kings of earth take customs or taxes? From their sons or from strangers? And Peter said to him, from strangers. And then Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. And when you have opened its mouth, you will find a piece of money. Take that and give it to them for me and you. So these Jewish people came and questioned Peter. Does the master, does your teacher, does he have to pay the temple tax like everybody else does? And so Jesus kind of gives him this roundabout talk about the sons of the strangers, who do we take it from? And he says, you know, really, they don't need it from me. But just to not cause problems, so everybody will see that we pay the tax, tells him, go out there, cast your hook into the water, pull it up, and you're going to find a fish, and that fish is going to have, there's the Greek word, a stater. That was going to be the perfect amount of money that would pay for both Jesus and Peter and pay their temple tax. So even Jesus paid the temple tax. Well, the years kept on going by. Temple tax, after a while, was not the only tax issue that was brought before Jesus. There were some other tax issues as well. In Matthew 22, now the Pharisees, they're trying to figure out a way to stump Jesus. They're trying to get him in Jesus in trouble, trying to catch him in a trap. So they say this, Matthew 22 and 15. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth. Now, nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, why do you test me, you hypocrites? Show me the tax money. So they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, whose image and inscription is this? And they said to him, Caesar's. And he said to them, render therefore to Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and to God the things which are God's. And when they heard him say these words, they marveled and left him and went away. So did you notice the name of the coin changed? It was no longer a shekel anymore they're talking about. Now they're talking about a denarius. Well, that's because they're talking about a different tax. We're not talking about the temple tax anymore. This is the tax that goes to Caesar in Rome. This was the Roman citizen tax. And so now they're trying to get Jesus. Do Jews have to pay the Roman tax? That's basically what they're saying. Because if Jesus said, yes, we need to pay the Roman tax, then everybody would say, oh, see, he's pro-Roman. See, he's siding with the Romans other than the Jews. And if he said no, then they would turn around and tell the Romans, Jesus is an insurrectionist who says we don't have to pay taxes. So they were trying to catch him, and Jesus was too smart for all of them. He just said, let me see the coin. Whose name is on it? Caesar? Well, give to Caesar what's Caesar's, and give to God what's God. And there's a very important concept there, I think, that's going to be brought out here in a little bit. You're either on God's side or you're on the other side. There's a worldly side and there's a godly side. And he said, let the worldly side take care of the worldly side. If you owe Caesar money, if it's got Caesar's name on it, then give Caesar's money back. Pay taxes to him. There's a worldly side, and there is a godly side. But as the years continue to go on, many Jews, and then also many Christians, started being greatly offended by some of the money and the inscriptions that they had to deal with on these coins. Now, I'm going to kind of lump Jews and Christians together because that's what the Romans did. The Romans did not see a separation of these two religions until sometime later, probably about the turn of the first century. They just saw Christians as a part of Jews, of Judaism. In fact, there's even one point where Paul is brought before Festus, and he is described in his trial. They said he's a ringleader of a sect called the Nazarenes. So they didn't even see him as their own individual religious group. They saw Christians as under the umbrella of Judaism, at least early on in the first century. So I'm just going to kind of lump these together. There were a whole bunch of Jews and Christians who were greatly offended by some of this Roman coinage, which you may have never thought about before. Well, I found a picture. That is one of the old Roman coins. That is Augustus Tiberius Caesar. That is his inscription. And this is what it says on it. And it's kind of broken up and abbreviated in Latin. The gist of it is Caesar Augustus Tiberius, son of the divine Augustus. Son of the god Augustus. So Augustus Caesar, when he had become Caesar, he declared himself to be a god. So on his coins, it would say in Latin, the god Augustus. And Tiberius here is the son of God. Well, the Jews didn't like that. The Christians didn't like that. And I got to thinking about it, I don't think I'd like that either. So there's a quarter right there. And there's a picture of old George Washington. Liberty doesn't bother me. In God we trust doesn't bother me. United States of America doesn't bother me. Quarter dollar. E pluribus unum, that just means out of many is one. That doesn't bother me. But what if it said on the back, George Washington, son of the Almighty God? Would that bother us? Would that be against our conscience? I think I'd have a problem with that. I think I'd have a problem if I pulled off a penny, and there's an Abraham Lincoln, and it said, Abraham Lincoln, our Lord and Savior. I think I'd have an issue with that. And that's exactly what the Christians and the Jews did. They didn't like dealing with this money because it had these inscriptions. Not just the Romans. It was all over. All of these different entities. These kings, these emperors, whoever it was that was in charge. A lot of them, they called themselves gods. And they would print that on their money. They didn't like that. So we've got to keep following money. So that led to a new position. And that position is a money changer. So money changers were used outside the temple during the Jewish feast times. And so you get up to the time of Passover, there was about a 10-day window where these money collectors could start setting up tables throughout the land. When it got to a certain day, they had to move it to the temple. And I believe it was the 25th day of the month of Adar was the last day that they could set up in the temple, and they would change out the money. So people would come in with these inscriptions and said stuff about, you know, Julius Caesar is God. Well, then they would convert it into the half shekel. And so then the Jews in their conscience would be able to then offer this half shekel into the treasury of the temple instead of offering something that had this blasphemous inscription upon it. And that's where we come across Matthew 21 and 12. Jesus, in the last week of his life, goes into the temple and he sees these money changers. And they have a legitimate job. They are changing out Roman coins and coins from all over the empire. They are converting them into the shekel so that can be used as payment for the temple tax. And it says, Jesus went into the temple of God and drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he said to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. So what were these money changers doing? Why were they a den of thieves? It sounds like a pretty honest job. Well, probably not. Coins came from all over the empire. They had, many of them had this blasphemous inscriptions put on them about the Son of God and whatnot. And so they would convert them to these half shekels. These money changers were making a pretty good rate. of exchange. They were making pretty good surcharge, I guess you might say. For a nominal fee, they would exchange your money. And so Jesus did not appreciate that they were making money out of this conversion to the temple tax. So things are getting kind of rough in the empire. Roman Empire was not always a smooth-running organization. It was huge, huge. The year 68 and 69 were pretty bad in the Roman Empire. I got thinking about it. If I said, boy, 68 and 69, that was a rough time. A whole bunch of you would probably shake your head and say, I remember that. Because 68 was pretty rough. That was when MLK was shot. That's when RFK was shot. That's when the riots in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention happened. That's when the Tet Offensive occurred in Vietnam and the whole war just flipped on top of itself. I bet you'd say, yes, 68, 69, that was pretty rough. I'm not talking about 1968 or 1969. I'm talking about the year 68, 69 A.D. So during the time that a lot of these books were getting written, there was a lot of crazy things going on in the Roman Empire. It started with a guy named Nero. And Nero was the emperor of Rome. And remember, he kind of went crazy? He was the one who set the city on fire and then fiddled as Rome burned, as the story goes, and then he blamed it on the Christians. And then he went crazy and then he committed suicide. So that was Nero. And that started in the next year after Nero's death. It was called the Year of Four Emperors. So we go through a presidential change sometimes every 4 years. Could you imagine having four in 1 year and not knowing who was in charge? Not knowing who was in control? And one person claims one thing and one person claims another? Those January 6th uprisings were nothing compared to what was going on a daily basis there in the Roman Empire in the year AD 69. There was four emperors fighting for control. First was named Galba, then there was Otho, Vitellius, and Vespasian. And they all assumed power of the Roman Empire somewhere during that year. And they may last for a couple months or 3 months or 4 months, and there were civil wars and they were fighting, and they were starting to get pretty crazy. How was a normal Roman citizen supposed to know who was in charge? How would they show their support? Were you following Galba or were you following Otho? Were you following Otho or were you following Vitellius? It was a crazy situation. It was a time of upheaval. Well, the way a lot of people started to do it was the money. That's how they decided and how they showed their loyalty. This is a cool little picture here. There's a Greek word here. We're going to come back to it here in a minute. And by the way, just stay with me. This is going to be an awesome lesson at the end. Just stay with me. There's a Greek word here, and it means mark. It literally means like to bang it with a hammer, to mark an engraving or an etching in metal. So here would be the original coin. Maybe this was the coin of Nero. And then you wanted to show that you didn't follow Nero anymore. You followed the next guy. You know, see that imprint, that mark right there? The coins would be marked. Sometimes they'd have holes drilled in them. Sometimes they would just pound it. And they would leave a mark or an impression or an indention onto the coin. And that showed, well, I don't want this guy anymore. I'm with the new guy. And so you would have marked coins. And that became very common throughout the Roman Empire. There's several of them right there. This one right here, you can actually read it. This is Nero. But once Nero is gone, we don't want to be on Nero's side anymore. So can you see how they put this little indention right here on this guy's throat? Now there's an indention. It's pounded in there. It was a marked coin. And that meant that, well, we didn't follow Nero anymore. We followed the next guy. And that's how you showed your loyalty to the new emperors. This one's real obvious to see. This impression, this dent right there that's found in this coin. This one's up in the middle of this guy's head, right about his temple. You can see an indention. That was called marking a coin, or a countermark of a coin. Well, then I came across this just this week. You're not going to believe this. But a bunch of these emperors would start minting their own coins. Trivia question, I learned this. How many mints, how many places in the United States mint coins? Anybody know? There's two. Coins are only minted in one of two places. It's either Philadelphia or Denver. And that's the only place. Now, there may be some other treasuries that sit in the mountain, but that's the only two places that mint coins. Well, they're pretty, you know, regulated. Well, back in these days, anybody that could smelt down silver or gold could make their own coins. And those suckers started cheating like crazy. I don't know what I just did here. They started cheating. There we go. We'll get the cut back up here in a second. I found a study that just was done recently. They started putting together some X-ray technology. And on that X-ray technology, if I get my paper, here it goes. They were able to X-ray some of these old coins. And they found a coin that was marked by Galba. And they were supposed to be 100% gold. He was 89% gold. So they were short, kind of like watering down the drinks a little bit. They were short the amount of gold they were putting in their coins. Old gold dropped down to 83%. Vespasian, he did pretty good. And then after AD 74, every coin they found was at least 99% pure gold. So these guys were, they were tricking. They were trying to make sure that they could get as many coins into circulation to show that they were actually in charge. Well, because of that, Roman officials started getting really wary about the money and the coins that were being passed around through the empire. Because they weren't all pure gold. They weren't all pure money. And things were just getting a little bit tricky, a little bit on edge. So whose side are you on? Roman society was intent upon pushing a very progressive agenda upon its citizens. They wanted emperor worship to be front and foremost in their daily lives. It was prevalent, and Roman citizens were expected to participate. And so those that proudly carried these marked Roman coins were seen as friends of the empire. So if you wanted to support Nero, you would carry Nero coins. If you wanted to support another guy, you would carry marked coins. And they'd get into the marketplace, and some of the markets, they wouldn't accept certain coins. They had to be marked a certain way because they weren't pure gold. So they didn't want to deal with a lot of this counterfeit coinage. You had to be showing that you were on the side of the true Roman Empire. It was a great temptation for Jews, as Christians as well, to renounce their religion. Great pressure on this. And the marked coins became a symbol of those who had accepted the status quo of the Roman Empire. And they were accepting what was going on and the life that they were living. A lot of Christians were given the opportunity, either you use these coins, either you start acting like a Roman citizen, or you can just sit here and starve. And the option is either you renounce your religion, or you're going to starve. And a lot of folks did. They just refused to accept what the Roman Empire was trying to bring forth. So I told you we'd come back to this word. This is the Greek word that means to mark. It's only used a couple times in the New Testament. It means a stamp or an imprinted mark. Figuratively, it says a mark providing undeniable identification, like a symbol giving irrefutable connection between parties. Later, it became the identification marker, like with an owner's unique brand mark. So the idea of marking something is very similar to now to how a rancher will brand their cattle or brand their horses to show ownership and what side you're on and who you belong to. That word is used a couple times. First is in Acts 17 and 29. It says, therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising. That word shaped right there, that's that Greek word that means branded, brand marked, imprinted upon, marked, etched, something with the idea of showing ownership. Guess where the rest of the uses of those words are found? They're all in the book of Revelation. Okay? So we get to the time of Revelation, there's all this stuff going on with these coins and these marked coins, and you have to have certain markings on certain coins to be able to use them in the marketplace. And you had to be able to have certain coins to be accepted as a member of the Roman Empire, or else you could be banished from the marketplace. Your money would be no good. And then all of a sudden in Revelation 13, John is trying to draw upon this. And he makes a statement that has caused probably more worry and more issue and more problems than just about any other over the last several hundred years. It's Revelation 13 and verse 16. He says, he calls us all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And then that next verse uses this number of 666. And people have freaked out over this for the last couple hundred years, trying to figure out what in the world John means. Who's the 666? What's the mark of the beast? What does that mean? Are we all going to have barcodes etched on our forearm? Is that what that means? You know, there's a couple books that came out. The first one was from a lady named Mary Stuart Ralph. It's called The New Money System 666. That was from 1982. She is the one who first, as far as I can consider, came up with the idea that you're going to get, everybody's going to get a UPC barcode and the government would have connection. You probably heard that before. Maybe it's going to be true. I don't know. But I don't think that's what John was talking about in the book of Revelation. Then we get the Bill Gates. You've probably heard this as well. This conspiracy theory says Bill Gates, in conjunction with the Chinese, invented COVID. So that way he could present the vaccine, and within the vaccine, shoot microchips in everybody, so then that way the government could track everybody, because that's the mark of the beast. You may have heard that. Maybe there's some truth to it. I don't know, but I don't think that's what John was talking about in Revelation chapter 13. What John was talking about, he was taking a very, very common knowledge to his audience, to his first century audience. They understood the idea of the marked coins and the mark of the beast, the mark of the emperor. You had to have a certain type of coin before you were allowed to use it in the marketplace. I'll give you a couple biblical examples too of this. Remember the story of the Passover? That in the original Passover there in Egypt, the Israelites had to go in and mark the door with blood so that the angel, when he flew over, he knew that house was safe. I want you to think about this for a second. Did that angel need any help? Did the angel not know whose were gods and whose were not? Did he really need that blood on the door? The angel that could kill 185,000 Assyrians like that, did that angel really need help knowing who were God's people and who were not? I don't think so. It was symbolic. It was symbolic showing that the nation of Israel, the Israelites, put the blood on their door. It wasn't for the benefit of the angel. It was because it was a symbol of showing whose side you're on. Are you on God's side? Were you on the Egyptian side? Here's another man I know, Ezekiel, the 9th chapter. Ezekiel has a vision. And it's kind of opposite the mark of the beast. It kind of goes the other way. In this vision, it said, bring me 6 guys fully armed. And here comes these 6 guys with swords. And then here comes this guy, it says, with an ink horn. So I guess it's just a pen of some sort. And it says, I want you to go out into the town. And everybody that is upset and crying and bothered by the sin that they see, put a mark on the forehead. And so the first angel goes out, puts marks on the forehead. Then the next group comes out and begins to kill everybody that does not have the mark on the forehead. So it's opposite of what Revelation is. What was the purpose of the mark? Could that angel not tell who was righteous and who was unrighteous? The angel could have told just fine. But that mark, it showed what side you were on. It showed who you supported. Were you on God's side or were you on the other side? And I believe that's exactly what John was trying to do in his 13th chapter of Revelation. I believe John was using a very well-known example of the mark of the empire to make his point to his first century audience, something they could understand. They understand the story of Ezekiel putting the mark on the forehead, and he kind of combines these two ideas. And they understood the mark of the beast being found on the coins. They understood what that meant. They had to decide whose side were they on. Were they on God's side, or were they on Satan's side? That's all there is to it. Nothing more, nothing less. In short, the mark of the Roman coins showed one's loyalty. Which Roman emperor were they following? Who did they show their loyalty to? Likewise, I believe the mark of the beast that John was talking about, I don't think we need to get caught up trying to figure out what 666 is and who the mark of the beast and what's happening to... It was written to the first century people. Same idea. The mark of the beast shows who their loyalty was with. Are they on God's side? Are they on Satan's side? And I believe people are spending way too much time and energy and emotion trying to figure out what this mark must correspond to. And when we do that, I think we miss the entire meaning of the symbol. The symbol is, whose side are we on? Are we on God's side? Are we on man's side? Are we on God's side? Are we on Satan's side? Are we on God's side? Are we on the emperor's side? Whose side are we on? That's the story of following the money. So we started way back in Exodus talking about temple tax. The temple tax showed whose side you were on. When they paid that temple tax, they were saying to God, this is a ransom. We owe our life to you. I don't think it's any different when we get to the book of Revelation either. Whose side are we on? Are we on God's side? Or are we trying to hang out with the world? Are we trying to hang out with Satan? Are we trying to hang out with the emperor's side? We always got to ask ourselves the question, whose side are we on?